This week on Our World, President Obama at the Copenhagen Climate Conference, an update on the H1N1 swine flu, and Science Magazine's breakthrough of the year.
The main thing was that it walked upright, just as we do. All of this is very different from what people were expecting. And of course, you know, scientists love surprises.
Finding a 4-million-year-old human ancestor and other milestones of the year in science and more. I'm Art Chimes. Welcome to VOA Science and Technology Magazine, Our World. The UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen ended on Friday. In a speech to the final session, President Obama said the United States was committed to cutting greenhouse gas emissions, aiding poor countries in reducing their emissions, and supporting a system to ensure that countries keep their pledges.
We can embrace this accord, take a substantial step forward, continue to refine it, and build upon its foundation. We can do that, and everyone who is in this room will be part of a historic endeavor. One that makes life better for our children and our grandchildren.
Or, he said, we can choose to delay while the danger of climate change grows until it is irreversible. Perhaps a more immediate challenge facing the world is the H1N1 or swine flu pandemic. The World Health Organization this week said it's too soon to declare victory against the viral disease, which so far has killed nearly 8,000 people worldwide. A senior WHO official says countries should continue to take steps to protect their public health. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The H1N1 influenza pandemic has been around for about 8 months, but in some places, the spread of the virus is not as widespread as some had feared. The World Health Organization says this is not long enough to be able to consider the pandemic over. WHO notes the pandemic is a global event, not a regional one. Since the virus is spreading around the world, it says it is normal for the illness to be more severe in some places than in others. For example, WHO finds infections are continuing at quite high levels in some parts of Europe, such as France and Switzerland, in parts of Central Asia, and in some large countries, such as Russia. But Special Advisor to the WHO Director General on Pandemic Influenza, Keiji Fukuda, says the pandemic seems to have peaked and is on the way down in some parts of the world, including North America and some European countries.
But one of the big questions which is still before us is whether we expect to see yet another wave of activity occur, perhaps in the late winter or in the early spring months. And the answer right now is that we simply are not able to answer this question right now.
Fukuda says WHO is continuing to monitor the situation, but is unable to predict whether or not there will be an upsurge of activity in early 2010. Because of the uncertainties, he says WHO believes it is vital to provide support to vulnerable countries. And the best way to help them, he says, is by providing them with vaccines against the disease. As of now, he says 6 manufacturers in 12 countries have pledged about 180 million doses of the vaccine to WHO. They will be distributed to approximately 95 countries.
The first doses have not gone out yet. But we are, I think, very close to that.
Fukuda adds it is not too late to get the vaccines out to the countries.
The pandemic virus is now a virus which is really spread around the world, and it is quite likely this is an infection that we will continue to see circulating for a number of years. And so I think that it remains quite prudent to push ahead with the vaccination effort.
Fukuda says Azerbaijan, Afghanistan, and Mongolia will be the first 3 countries to receive the vaccines. He says they will be followed by a group of 35 countries. After that, the vaccines will be distributed to the remaining vulnerable countries on WHO's list. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here in the United States, meanwhile, officials Thursday urged Americans to get vaccinated, saying there are ample supplies of the vaccine, which previously had been limited to high-risk groups. For a variety of reasons, production of the H1N1 vaccine has lagged behind demand. The vaccine for the so-called swine flu is made in the same way as the seasonal flu vaccine, in chicken eggs. But the government's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said the goal is to perfect new ways to make a vaccine.
What we really want to do is get away from that and get it to be 21st century technology, molecular biology, recombinant DNA technology, where you have very good control over the process. It's rapid, it's consistent, and it proves to be something that we can rely on.
Another long-term goal is to develop a vaccine that will attack parts of the flu virus that are unchanged from year to year. If scientists succeed, a new vaccine won't be needed for each new strain of flu, the way it's done today, and immunity should carry over from year to year. We've got some astronomy news this week about the discovery of some more or less Earth-like planets circling distant stars. First, astronomers report finding a planet that's about 3 times the diameter of Earth and about 6.6 times more massive. For astronomers, that's pretty similar to our own planet. And David Charbonneau of the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics told reporters the similarity to Earth goes further. The planet likely has liquid water, he says, just like Earth. But it's very hot, and only very high atmospheric pressure keeps the water from boiling away.
The main difference here is that although our planet is hotter, the higher pressure also ensures that water is liquid. But the surface of our planet probably wouldn't be anything like the surface of the Earth and therefore wouldn't host life as we know it.
Charbonneau led an international team of astronomers who report their discovery this week in the journal Nature. A separate planet discovery was reported in the Astrophysical Journal, where scientists described finding a total of 6 planets orbiting 2 sun-like stars. 2 of the planets are described as super-Earths, meaning they're larger than Earth, about 5 to 8 times more massive in this case, but still a lot smaller than the gas giants in our solar system, Jupiter and Saturn. University of California astronomer Gregory Laughlin, a member of the team that discovered the planets, says the 2 planets are composed largely of rock and metal, just like Earth.
But the excitement in these discoveries is they point the way toward the detection of truly Earth-like planets in a very short period of time, within the next few years.
The planets were detected using some of the most advanced telescopes on Earth, but even big telescopes can't see a small planet next to a bright star, so the astronomers used an indirect method, measuring the wobble of the star that results from the gravitational pull of an orbiting planet. Around 400 planets outside our solar system have been discovered so far, but relatively few are, like the ones reported this week, close enough in size and characteristics to be considered Earth-like. One more bit of space news this week. On Monday, NASA launched a new telescope into orbit. Officials say the new space telescope, known as the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, or WISE for short, will help them to discover, photograph, and research thousands of previously undetected stars, galaxies, and potentially threatening asteroids. As VOA's Mackenzie Babb reports, WISE will allow scientists to look at the universe closer than ever before.
Have you ever looked up at the night sky and wondered what's out there? Well, NASA's Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, or WISE, is on a mission to find out. Using a 41-centimeter telescope and infrared detectors, the spacecraft will spend the next 9 months taking inventory of the cosmos. WISE Deputy Project Scientist Amy Meinzer explains the mission's all-sky survey, which will provide what she calls a Google map to the universe.
It's literally looking everywhere in the whole sky, and it will give us a map that we can use to find the most interesting places to look. And that's what we need to be able to use our big telescopes efficiently. And also, too, if you want to find the most rare and unusual types of objects in the universe, you need to look everywhere to be able to find them.
Meinzer says the panoramic picture of the sky WISE will provide is like a wide-angle lens for scientists, who will then use space telescopes, such as the Hubble and the upcoming James Webb, to zoom in on points of interest. Researchers already have a good idea about some of the things WISE will find, such as ultraluminous galaxies, thousands of previously unseen stars, and about 100,000 undetected asteroids. While Meinzer says most of these orbiting rocks will pose no harm to Earth, she does expect to find at least several hundred new near-Earth objects, or asteroids that may one day threaten civilization.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they will hit the Earth anytime, but it's possible. And because of that, we would like to know more about the near-Earth object population.
WISE principal investigator Edward Wright says while scientists may not need to know the object's size, composition, and location right now, gathering such information is a necessary step toward future disaster prevention.
So far, we don't know of anything on a collision course. If we found out with enough warning, then it would be possible to launch a space mission and deflect the asteroid so it would not hit the Earth. So we would need a lot of warning.
Asteroids are just one of the estimated 1 million never-before-seen objects scientists anticipate WISE to uncover. However, both Meinzer and Wright agree that researchers' real expectation is to find the unexpected. The last time the sky was mapped in infrared was in 1983 by the Infrared Astronomy Satellite. Though revolutionary for its time, the craft's digital camera had only 62 pixels. By contrast, the WISE camera has 4 million pixels, allowing it to photograph the universe with extraordinary sensitivity and in great detail. Mackenzie Babb, VOA News, Washington.
And it's time again for our website of the week, when we showcase interesting and innovative online destinations. For those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, Monday is the first day of winter, which seems a good time to check out a website that's all about the snow.
Snowcrystals.com is a website that is about snowflakes and snow crystals and just generally ice phenomena.
Kenneth Liebrecht is a physics professor at Caltech, the California Institute of Technology, and for a decade he's been posting gorgeous photographs of snowflakes and a lot more at snowcrystals.com.
A little guide to different types of snowflakes. I talk some about the physics of snowflakes, and I even have a section on what I call designer snowflakes, which is us growing crystals in the lab and trying to understand how the physics works.
I had to ask him, as apparently everybody does, is it true that no two snowflakes are alike? Kenneth Liebrecht says, it depends on what kind you're talking about, but if you mean the classic, complex, six-sided version, well, the answer is yes.
They are so complicated that if you try to estimate how many ways you can make a snowflake, you get a huge number, not just billions and trillions, but bigger than the number of atoms in the universe. So the odds of seeing any two exactly alike are essentially zero.
Lots more, including videos of designer snowflakes being grown in the lab at snowcrystals.com, or get the link from our site, voanews.com. You're listening to Our World, the weekly science and technology magazine from VOA News. I'm Art Charnes in Washington. The prestigious journal Science is out this week with its top 10 breakthroughs of 2009, and with us to talk about it is Robert Kuntz, the magazine's deputy news editor. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, what do the editors of Science consider the top breakthrough of the year 2009?
The top breakthrough of 2009 is the fossil Ardipithecus ramidus. And this 4.4 million-year-old fossil from Ethiopia may tell us things that we'd never known before. It was very strange. It was very different from what anybody was expecting.
In what way?
The main thing was that it walked upright, just as we do. But what's unexpected about that is that our closest evolutionary relatives, the chimpanzees and gorillas, don't do that. They walk crouched over and they walk on their knuckles. And so there was an assumption that our common ancestor with them would have been something that also walked that way. And it turns out that no, Ardipithecus was designed for walking in trees or climbing trees. All of this is very different from what people were expecting. And, of course, you know, scientists love surprises.
Well, speaking of surprises, we have several space-related breakthroughs of the year, and one of them was the identification of water on the moon, but a couple of others. Can we talk about those?
Certainly.
Well, LCROSS was the name of the mission that NASA sent to look for water vapor and ice on the moon. Why is that important?
The poles of the moon have dark craters that never see sunlight because they're perpetual shadows that are cast over the rims of the craters. And those are some of the coldest places in the whole solar system. So if any ice were to wind up there, it really wouldn't go anywhere. So this year, NASA sent up a spacecraft and sent up its rocket stage with it and sent the rocket stage right into the moon to bomb the moon, basically, and see what came up. And they looked at it with a spectrometer, and they found that the molecules that were coming up included water.
One of the best ways that scientists have had of looking out in space has been the Hubble Space Telescope, and there was a repair mission to the Hubble that made your list. Why is that on the list?
This mission gave Hubble a new lease on life. It's now taking better pictures than ever before, and it should be good for years to come.
And just finally, the other space item, briefly, the pulsars detected by the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope.
That's right. Actually, this is part of a much broader work. Now, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope looks in a very particular part of the electromagnetic spectrum. That is, it's a kind of light that's the highest energy light. It's gamma rays. It's beyond X-rays, beyond the ultraviolet. And scientists had been able to look at stars and galaxies in that range before, but never with the kind of detail that the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope lets them do.
Well, let's get a little more down to earth, and on the list of breakthroughs for 2009, we have gene therapy. That's one of those developments that, you know, always seems to be on the verge of a breakthrough. What's different this year?
Well, gene therapy has had some reverses in the past, and it's very promising. The idea that you can go in, and if somebody has some sort of disease that's caused by flaw in the DNA, you could actually go in and find ways to repair the DNA, and then the person would be cured of the disease. Unfortunately, although people have been talking about doing this for decades, it has never worked out quite as well as people expected. This year, however, there were some very promising clinical results that indicate that it may be starting to work the way that people always hoped that it would. There was a form of inherited blindness called Leber's congenital amaurosis, and some researchers in Britain injected the eyes of patients with these viruses attached to genes, harmless viruses that would carry the genes into the right places in the cells so that they would repair this form of blindness. And that it turns out that the patients actually did regain some of their sensitivity to light. And in fact, some of them who were children actually managed to play sports just normally. So that's very promising.
Well, we don't have time for the rest of the Science Magazine breakthroughs of the year, but you can read all about them at sciencemag.org, where you can also get a heads up on some areas that the journal flags as likely hot topics for 2010. Robert Kuntz, what are some of those areas to watch?
Well, some of the hot areas that are coming up, there is almost certain to be a new wave of research in what's called induced pluripotent stem cells. These are these cells that can that can grow into almost any other kind of cell that you need in the body. And there are sure to be more studies of that in 2010. Also in 2010, there's a new satellite is going to be going up, actually an instrument to be installed on board the space station. It's called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. It's going to be looking for cosmic rays, antimatter, and strange particles that have been predicted but that nobody's ever seen before. This is also the year in which NASA is going to have to decide what it's going to do about the human space program. It will determine the whole direction that the future space program in the United States is going to take. And so that's something that we'll be looking at very closely.
Okay, Robert Kuntz, Deputy News Editor at the Journal Science. Thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to help.
And finally today, many people need glasses in order to see better, but do more people need glasses to see than in the past? A new analysis of data shows that the number of people with myopia who need glasses to see things at a distance has increased over the past 40 years, at least in the United States. Health reporter Rose Hoban takes a look.
No one is sure why people end up needing glasses to see distances. The number of people with poor distance vision changes with age, gender, ethnicity, occupation, even which country you live in. Epidemiologist Susan Vitale from the U.S. National Eye Institute says the data suggests that the disorder has become more common because eye strain is a side effect of modern life.
There are some known risk factors for myopia. They include having a family history, like if your parents are nearsighted, you're more likely to be nearsighted. But it's not a one-to-one thing. The same thing with sort of having a higher education level or doing a lot more near work or close-up work. You have a higher risk of being myopic.
Vitale says in some Asian countries, Myopia is being called an epidemic. In China, about 2 out of every 5 people are myopic, and the rate increases with the amount of education a person has. To assess the rate of myopia in the United States, Vitaly looked at data from large, nationwide health surveys done every decade. In the early 1970s, researchers found that about 25% of people aged 12 to 54 years old had trouble seeing at a distance.
When we applied that same definition in the newer data from 1999 to 2004, we got a 41.6% rate, which is a really pretty big jump from 25% to 41%.
Vitaly says the good news is that myopia is easy to treat with corrective lenses, either glasses or contact lenses. But if close to half the population needs glasses, those costs can add up. Vitaly says it's important for people with eye problems to see an eye doctor regularly in order to maintain good vision. She also says if researchers could better identify the risk factors for deteriorating vision, perhaps they could prevent people from losing their eyesight in the first place. Vitaly's article is published in the Archives of Ophthalmology. I'm Rose Hoban.
That's our show for this week. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at ourworld@voanews.com or write us at Our World, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Our program was edited by Rob Sivak. Bob Doty is the technical director. And this is Art Chimes inviting you to join us online at voanews.com/ourworld or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science and technology in Our World.